Coming up on Golf Today, the CEO of the USGA, Mike Wann, stops by to talk about an important anniversary in the game. Plus, we get his take on the state of golf as this tumultuous year winds down. And the world number five, John Rahm, speaks at the CJ Cup at Congaree in South Carolina. Fresh off his win in Spain, is world number one and major number two in his future? And beware the injured golfer. Rolex number one Jin Young Ko is not 100%, but she's in the field in Korea. Can she win with a wrist not at full strength? Showing some grit on Golf Today.
Golf Today.
Golf Today on a Tuesday. Dave Manack alongside Eamon Lynch of Golf Week Magazine. He's been following golf at all this summer. This guy right here breaks a lot of stories, breaks a lot of news, and he broke the news this morning that the PGA Tour is set to announce the four additional events with elevated status for 2023. This comes in addition to the nine that were already announced back in August at the Tour Championship. Now, the four new elevated events are expected to be the WM Phoenix Open, RBC Heritage, the Wells Fargo Championship, and the Travelers Championship as well. And as you can see right there on your screen, they join the likes of the Players, the playoff events, and the Invitationals in elevated status. So what does that mean? Well, at the Tour Championship, you recall in August, Commissioner Jay Monahan announced a number of changes to the future structure of the Tour to combat LIV golf and future defections. In that announcement, the commissioner introduced the idea of elevated events that would guarantee the presence of the game's biggest names, as well as a purse of at least $20 million. How about that? Eamon Lynch, it's coming together. We got Phoenix in February, RBC, Hilton Head in April. We're seeing kind of a geographic diversity. We're seeing a schedule come together.
These are the final pieces of the puzzle of these elevated events that Jay Monahan announced back in August. And it's key to note that this is based on the schedule that had already been published and announced by the PGA Tour before the idea of elevated events even emerged. So they had little room to work with. And that's why you see so many compromises in a way in this. We're already seeing our Canadian friends wondering why the RBC event at Hilton Head is elevated rather than the Canadian Open. Well, if you look at the schedule, there's a four-week stretch that goes from the Memorial to the Canadian Open to the US Open and then to the Travelers. So if the Travelers is going to be elevated, that would be four in a row.
Right.
It would be elevated when you add in major championships as well. So everything tends to be something of a compromise, and players are going to have to compromise as well, Damon. We know players who have for many years skipped the Phoenix Open simply because the vibe isn't to everyone's taste out there. And it changes the vibe as well of the RBC Heritage, which has always been known as a kind of a low-key decompression week
right
after the Masters. Now you're going to have the best players in the world there. And there are others that benefit. I mean, particularly, I think, Wells Fargo always draws a strong field, I think, at Quail Hollow.
Yeah.
But it fits into a perfect point in the schedule for them coming 2 weeks before the PGA Championship. Maybe not as good news for the Byron Nelson, which comes the next week before the PGA Championship. So there's just a lot of give and take here, for sure.
In Quail Hollow, let's be honest, the President's Cup, Quail Hollow continued to look incredible. The crowds there were remarkable as well. Surely the Tour wanting to take advantage of that market. But what about, in your reporting, have you heard about the potential for rotating events? Now, these four events are clearly happy. The sponsors will be happy, the fans. But what about some of the other events? Will they have an opportunity to be elevated in the future?
Yes, based on the sources I've talked to, the four that will be announced this week, the players are due to be informed tomorrow of this news, is that those events will rotate. The nine that were previously announced are permanently elevated, but they will rotate four every year in an attempt to give every sponsor and tournament the opportunity to have an elevated field every few years. Perhaps they don't necessarily want to make the investment for every year because it is a substantial number that we're talking to get to that elevated status. But this would rotate the events around a little more. Plus, once you start to go back to a 2024 calendar year schedule, then you can potentially move tournaments around, because that's also an issue the Tour is going to have to face, is if a sponsor wants an elevated event, it depends very much where that event falls on the schedule in relation to other elevated events and commitments. So you may see a schedule that juggles a little bit more than we've seen over the past years, where people have become used to seeing certain tournaments in certain places all the time. But the real key that we now have to see now is the who are the top 20 players who are going to be guaranteed here, because that's actually determined by the Player Impact Programme. And the criteria for that has changed. It's taken out a little social media element, added an awareness element. Still kind of a vaguely defined form to come up with those 20 names. But it's worth noting that the Player Impact Programme doubled in size this year from $50 million to $100 million and will reward 20 players instead of 10. So the tour is compensating these guys for the commitment to these events a year ahead of them doing it.
There seemed to be some unknowns in August when the Commissioner, Jay Monahan, addressed the media at the Tour Championship. It looks like things are starting to become more and more clear as we look ahead to 2023. But how about this week in golf? For the second season in a row, the PGA Tour will make a stop at Congaree Golf Club. Back in 2021, it was for the Palmetto Championship. This week, the Tour returns to Ridgeland, South Carolina, for the CJ Cup. And what a field the CJ Cup will boast this week. 15 of the top 20 players in the world are in this field, including the world number one, Scottie Scheffler, number three, Rory McIlroy, and the world number five, John Rahm. Mr. Rahm coming off that big win 2 weeks ago at the DP World Tour Spanish Open. Emotional win for him. He tied his hero, Seve Ballesteros, with three Spanish Open titles. Now in South Carolina, the world number five spoke with the media earlier today.
It's been nice to, after finishing what hasn't been my best PGA Tour season, even though it was still pretty good, to go to Wentworth, have the Sunday, and then follow it up by playing good in Spain and having a very, very meaningful win. Said it before, I understand it's not the strongest field, but it's something that means a lot to me, and sometimes controlling myself and the crowd can be a little bit harder. So for me, it was a week to be proud of. So hopefully I can keep that good play going and translate those wins to the PGA Tour, which I've done in the past. I've played great in the fall in European Tour in the past, and I've translated it to the PGA Tour. So I'm excited to be here. Have not played the golf course yet. I saw some of that event they had here last year, and all the feedback I've gotten from the golf course is that it's fantastic and it's in absolute perfect shape. So I can't wait to get out there.
And that Spanish Open win came at the end of a trending period for John Rahm. Here are his last five worldwide starts going back to the FedEx St. Jude Championship, including that very near miss, the 62 Sunday at Wentworth in the BMW PGA Championship, where he tied for second with Rory McIlroy behind Shane Lowry. And it's time now for a little John Rahm edition of Buy or Sell. We're pleased to be joined by Paige McKenzie. Paige, here's the first question. Buy or sell John Rahm, coming off that Torrey Pines US Open victory 2021. Does he win major number two in 2023?
Buy. I am buying this all day long. I'm very bullish on John Rahm for this upcoming year. Part of the reason why I am on major championships is his style of play. When you look at, he is the best driver on the PGA Tour, at least he was last season, and only two players were better than him in greens and regulation percentage. When you talk about major championships, what do you talk about? You need to hit fairways and greens. You need to be a ball striker. And that very much suits John Rahm's game, especially right now. And also, I would also, maybe a little tip of the cap to the odds makers and what they're projecting for next year. If you are interested at all, it's plus 300 on PointsBet. He's the second favorite for winning any or one of those majors next year. So I'm not the only one that thinks John Rahm has a good shot next year.
And Paige sees him quite a bit out in Arizona, you know, Silver Leaf, all over the place, hitting golf shots, working on his game. Are you as bullish as Paige?
I am on John Rahm. I think he had a lot of distractions this year. You know, there's a lot going on in terms of adding a second young child to the family as well. And T12 being his highest finish in a major was in stark contrast to last year when he didn't finish any worse than eighth in the majors. And when you look at his statistical performance, the only part of John Rahm's game that seems to have shown a noticeable drop-off is strokes gained around the green, scrambling. I mean, if you look at his sand saves, even as an example, he gets up and down 40% of the time. Compare that with the tour leader, Shane Lowry, at 67%. At that level, that's an enormous gap. But to me, it suggests more sloppiness than any kind of fundamental issue. And I just don't see a lot of weak spots in John Rahm's game. He seems like the kind of guy who's in a good place in his life. He's clearly in a good place with his game based on the results that we just saw there. And he does have an impressive record in major championships. He puts himself in the mix quite a lot. I still think that the temperament is always a bit of a question mark with John, but I don't see any compelling reason to argue against John Rahm being one of those four guys who's going to hoist a trophy next year.
I agree with you. I'm buying this. I think John Rahm in 2022, probably an anomaly season for him. I sense the kind of the consternation about the future of the PGA Tour, kind of wondering where he fit in terms of the strength of his voice compared to Tiger or Rory. I think that was part of the story of this summer for him. Also, the growing family, second child, can maybe just slightly take your eye off the ball just a little bit. And also, you mentioned the short game. Last 3 years, from 24th to 42nd to 143rd in strokes gained around the green. It's a noticeable drop-off, but to me, he is someone built for major championships, four top tens in the Masters, a couple in the PGA, a couple in the U.S. Open, including a victory on a West Coast venue. We're going to the West Coast in 2023, a couple hours north of Torrey Pines. We'll be in Los Angeles, also has a top 10 in the Open Championship as well. I think he has got a fantastic game. I think he is strong mentally. Physically, I agree he can run hot, but I think it's passion. And I think it can be a help and a benefit for him sometimes because no one is going to be tougher on himself or bigger critic than John Rahm.
Yeah, he doesn't seem to throw himself off very much. I have heard other players occasionally mutter that it was slightly unsettling when John was in full tilt at one point. But that doesn't happen very often. He plays with a much more even keel in a way than Seve does. Because back in the day, Seve could throw himself off with the kind of aggravation. We've seen even guys like Bubba Watson, who are somewhat highly strung on a golf course, throw themselves off. John Rahm performs at a level that is not thrown off easily, even by his own kind of angst that's going on the golf course. To me, he just seems like he's built for those kind of moments. He's in the prime of his career right now, 27. I do think this year is something of an anomaly when it comes to results. I don't expect it next year.
Well, how about next year? You know, winning a major will be one thing, Paige, but how about getting back to world number one for John Rahm? Are you buying or selling?
I'm buying this. I predicted it about a month ago, so I'm sticking with John Rahm as my horse for next year. And a lot has to do with kind of how I framed what he did last season. We take a look at where he fell historically in his career on that driving stat where I said I mentioned last season he was number one on the PGA Tour. It was the best driving year that he's ever had. And a lot of it had to do with the distance gains that he made. He gained over an 11-yard gain off of the tee when you take into consideration the average over the previous 5 years. So a massive improvement in his distance. So that may explain why the short game wasn't exactly what he was looking for. And then when you look at his putting, 2020 is highlighted as his best putting year. His second best was last year. So you combine the very best driving year with the second best putting year. And yes, you mentioned it, that the short game wasn't what he was looking for. And that's been a glaring and obvious negative for him. He was negative strokes gained around the green, as you mentioned, Damon and Eamon. But when you look at where he has played historically, it's been positive. He has a good short game, but perhaps maybe he was focused on a little more distance and let the short game slide a little bit. But I don't think that's going to be a problem for him moving forward, given the fact that there is no pattern of weakness in his short game. It was an outlier last season. So when you take all of that into consideration, yes, I think that John Rahm will finish the year as the number one player in the world because of the strength of his ball striking, his putting, and I think the short game's going to pick up next year.
That's a persuasive case, Damon. Are you persuaded by Paige's argument?
Not quite. And I know that Paige has done her homework, but I think that we're not taking into account the strength of Scottie Scheffler. And that's the only reason why I'm going to go against this. Because, yes, Cameron Smith is going to continue to tumble down the official world golf ranking, you would think. But I think that Scottie Scheffler, coming off of a four-win season, deserves the respect. You want to talk about a short game that won't quit. You want to talk about someone who's already got that first major championship, who's won on very different golf courses. I think Scottie Scheffler, he may, you know, have a couple of months or a couple of weeks as he did this year where the game isn't as tight as he wants it to be. But I think at the end of 2023, with the points he's accumulated, with the quality of golf that he has, with the way John Fields at Texas describes him of having the it factor before he ever even won on the PGA Tour, we saw it in full and living color in 2022. I think Scottie Scheffler, he may lose the ranking for a week or a month, but by the end of 2023, I think he'll be the man holding the number one ranking in the world.
I get to be the casting vote.
You are. We're 1-1 here.
In a way. And I don't think John Rahm's getting the number one ranking back next year, but I think it's got more to do with the math of how the world rankings work. Nine players this year in the official world golf ranking earned more points in 2022 than John Rahm. Most of his points came from that standout 2021 year. And as they cycle through this two-year car wash of how the points diminish in value over time. So John Rahm's got a little bit more riding in terms of what he might lose in 2023 as well. And he didn't, frankly, win an awful lot of points for the Spanish Open win, because now the way the rankings have changed, you're judged upon who you compete against. That
right.
determines the value of the world ranking points you get for a victory. And as we just heard from John Rahm, it wasn't the strongest field that he faced at the Open de España.
Yeah.
And his tendency and desire to support the European Tour events in Spain is a very noble cause, but it's probably
yes.
not going to do him a lot of good in the world rankings.
Nor did his win in Mexico either.
No, that was a different world ranking scenario
system.
Until
yes.
this one kicked in. But the flip side of that is, as we've just seen from this schedule, they're all going to be competing against the best players in the world consistently week
right.
in and week out next year. So there's going to be a lot at stake in those rankings. So a good couple of weeks in those events could make an enormous lot of headway for John Rahm. I just think the math is going to make it a little bit of an uphill struggle for him.
What do you think, Paige, about the math?
I mean, leave it to Eamon to break out the calculator and the world ranking breakdown. I appreciate it, and now it makes me call into question maybe how convicted I am that he will rise. And maybe instead, the three of us are at the very end of the year going to have a conversation about whether number one world ranking is actually the best player in the world.
Ooh.
If the math doesn't pan out.
Paige already making, you know, looking ahead just in case she needs a little backup for her argument. I like that.
It absolutely does, and she makes a compelling argument. Welcome back to Golf Today. With just three events remaining until the CME Group Tour Championship, the LPGA Tour is in South Korea. The BMW Ladies Championship, co-sanctioned by the Korean LPGA. Some of the world's best players have gathered at Oak Valley Country Club in Wonju, South Korea. And here are some of the notables in the field. You'll see a couple of contenders in the ongoing Player of the Year race, Athaya Thitico and Minji Lee. Lydia Ko, who's leading the Vera Trophy right now. You see one of the names on the left there, who we haven't seen for a while. World number one, Jin Young Ko.
Yeah, good to see her back, making her first start since August. Missed two straight cuts, including the AIG Women's Open, before confirming that a wrist injury would force her to take a break from golf. Now, earlier today, she spoke with the media about her wrist, saying, quote, "I'm a little bit uncomfortable that the wrist continues to come up. It's really difficult. I don't know how to explain what my wrist is like at the moment. It's not fully okay, but I'm not in a lot of pain. It's really difficult to explain the state of my wrist. But I have to say it's not at its worst. I don't think it's impacting my game that much. And if I don't do well, I don't think I can blame it on my wrist. I'm just going to do my best out there." Paige McKenzie, we've watched this player have an un-Jin Young Ko-like season. How concerned are you that she's coming back now with her wrist not necessarily 100%?
I am concerned. And it's so interesting that we're having this conversation as she's continuing to be ranked number one in the world. But it certainly has not been a typical Jin Young Ko season. And I think there may have been a lot of wrist injury stuff going on early in the year that we didn't know about. But it did show up in her golf game. When you look at her driving distance, she lost 8 yards off of the tee between last year and this year. And to me, that was concerning, but it's concerning with how she then hits her approach shots in. Jin Young Ko has historically been one of the best ball strikers the LPGA Tour has ever seen, certainly in the last decade. And when you compare the last two seasons, in 2021, when she hit the fairway, she hit 84% of her greens. Now that just deserves a round of applause because that's extraordinary. Even this season, minus that 8 yards, so think about 8 yards more into the greens, she still was hitting 80%. Where the real difference matters is when she misses the fairway. Massive difference because, again, she's 8 yards further away from the green. So she's lost 9% on her greens in regulation, barely hitting over 50% or half of her greens this season from outside of the fairway. So I think when I'm looking at Jin Young Ko, I saw all of that happen, and I'm thinking it has been an off year. Now knowing the injury, you can understand that even if it's feeling okay and she was playing earlier in the season, it may not be okay in her golf game.
Those stats are extremely telling, Paige. I will point out that at the end of last year, she was struggling with the wrist in Naples as well. She hit no more than a 52-degree wedge before every round in Naples in the CME Group Tour Championship. And what did she do? She hit her final 63 greens in regulation, shot 8-under-63. Nelly Korda said, "I just watched the Jin Young Ko show. That's how good she was, even when she wasn't 100%. So I wonder, Eamon, if it's possible that as she makes this return, she's just kind of lowering the expectations just a little bit for the outside and maybe for herself, and maybe just the athlete and the competitor will take over at this point, even if the wrist is not 100%.
I don't know if you can lower the expectations for Jin Young Ko, because historically she's been like a human version of Rust-Oleum. She won that CME Group Tour Championship in November of last year. She then took 4 months off dealing with that injury, and she came back and won the HSBC. Last year, she took 6 weeks off working on her swing, came back and won Portland. You know, she took 10 weeks off in 2020 during the pandemic and came back and finished tied third in a tournament. So she handles rust better than anyone else. And with that kind of record, it's very hard to then lower the expectations. I would tend to try to lower them in terms of what I would expect from her this week, given that she's only had 3 top tens on the LPGA Tour since March. She had 10 straight top tens before that period began. So there's definitely a little diminishment of her game that we have seen this year that is probably a combination of the injuries and the confidence issues. I'm not concerned as much about her coming back with the wrist injury and what she said about it today, simply because there's no evidence that she has been in any way reckless before or coming back too early. She's taken long breaks from the tour before, which to me is an encouraging sign that she's probably not risking too much this time. But it's still a matter of concern if the world number one's telling you that she's far from 100%.
Paige, there's also been the diminishing of the rivalry. I mean, you thought last year we saw it was Jin Young Ko and Nelly Korda. So outside of the wrist, I mean, these are two players that had the headlines a year ago. How much is it something outside the ropes? Maybe not having that competitor to say, well, she just won an Olympic gold medal. She just became number one. She just won a major. Just having that kind of tit for tat that we saw last season.
I don't know if that's what motivates Jin Young Ko. I think she is a lot more concerned with how she is doing things because she does things so well and so differently. So I don't know if that matters as much. I will say I kind of agree with Eamon in that I'm not necessarily concerned this week coming back. I'm concerned with the sustainability of coming back. And we've got a couple weeks left in the LPGA Tour season, and it's going to be trying if she's continuing to still deal with this. It's not just a one-off. It's a how is this going to maintain and stabilize for the rest of this season and or moving forward into next year. So that's my, I think, greater concern, big picture.
Yeah, it's a good point you make. When she's in full flight, nobody is better on the LPGA Tour. Well, folks, he used to lead the LPGA Tour as commissioner. Now he leads the USGA. We're talking about Mike Wann. He's joining the program to talk about a big investment the USGA is making to better the future of our game. Back on Golf Today, the USGA continuing its push to grow the game. They have been doing so with First Tee in celebration of 25 years of partnership. The USGA announcing that 25 First Tee chapters across America have received idea grants worth up to $25,000. The grants will be used to expand inclusion, diversity, equity, and accessibility efforts. In 2022, the USGA invested $325,000 into First Tee. With that, we welcome in the CEO of the USGA, Mike Wan. Always good to see you. The USGA was a founding partner of First Tee, and this partnership is celebrating its 25th anniversary this year. Why is this program so important to the USGA?
Well, hello, Damon, and you're right, it is important. I think at the USGA and really in golf in general, we believe in first experiences. That's why we're not only a founding partner of First Tee, a founding partner in Drive, Chip, and Putt in USGA LPGA Girls Golf, because these are first experiences that can actually change the face of this game long term. And what started as a $3 million investment in First Tee back in 1997 has turned into $30 million investment over the years. Because if we want to change the way this game looks and feels over the next 30 years, then we got to be committed to doing that, both with our mouth and with our money.
Mike, these are demographics in First Tee that are historically underrepresented in this game and frankly often made unwelcome in this game over the years. What kind of impact are these grants actually having at a grassroots level?
Yeah, it's a great question, Eamon, because at the end of the day, we want to make sure that we're not only supporting First Tee, but we're actually creating incentive too. And these idea grants really create incentive for you to address underserved markets, whether that's transportation, school programs, diverse coaches. We've seen some incredible results. I mean, I think of the Pasadena Latina golfer program, the Kentucky Cincinnati golfer disabled. It's making sure that these programs can reach out to an audience that might not otherwise get there. And if you think about just in this last year, 2021, 3.2 million people joined the game for the first time. And in those 3.2 that are coming into the game, they're 45% more likely to be non-Caucasian. They're 35% more likely to be women. So if you will, this funnel that's fueling the future of the game looks more diverse, is more diverse, and creates a different sport than we knew just 10 or 15 years ago. And that's really what these ideas and these programs are all about.
Mike, a couple of years ago in the middle of COVID, post-George Floyd, companies across the country and around the world were talking about DEI. Do you still feel like the energy is there, the priority is there, and that the momentum is there in these efforts?
Yeah, at least in the golf space, Damon, nothing has slowed down. In Make Golf Your Thing, we created six pillars to really make game-changing differences. And the reason we created six of them is because we wanted to make sure that we were attacking this thing from all different angles. We have a program that gave out about 45 grants to diverse programs in the marketplace. We built a procurement portal. So if you want to go into a marketplace like us going to LA next year for the US Open, we want to be able to go to a portal and be able to identify businesses that are run, led, and populated with diverse individuals. So we not only create a difference in terms of who's joining our game, but how our game spends money. I've said this many times, but if we want golf to look and feel exactly like it did 30 years ago, that's easy. Do exactly what we've been doing for the last 30 years. If we want to wake up and golf to be more inclusive, more diverse, more engaging, more like America, then we have to invest in that. We can't just sit back and assume that's going to happen. And programs like this, real grant money going to real grassroots programs, is how these differences can take place. And it's not just a USGA thing or a PGA Tour or LPGA thing. The game is engaged in Make Golf Your Thing. I just got off the phone with a White House Historically Black Colleges and Universities Initiative Task Force, making sure that the people coming out of those schools looking for employment can see all the opportunities within the game. Go back 5, 10, 15 years ago, we wouldn't have a connection with HBCUs, and we do today, and that's a difference.
Mike, speaking of spending money, this is a noble expenditure of money, but money's obviously a big topic in the game these days. This year, the USGA added $5 million to the prize fund at the US Open to get up to $17.5 million. As we've seen from the news today, you're looking at least a dozen PGA Tour events next year that will have purses of more than $20 million. Do you feel in any way a pressure to try to keep pace with this money arms race, or are you happy with where you are?
I think, Eamon, for us, we want to make sure that stepping onto a major venue like the U.S. Open feels major in a lot of ways. And I believe that purses is one of those ways. I also think if you ask anybody who won a U.S. Open, what was that U.S. Open worth, both financially and to your career, you won't hear about the winner's check. It's a multiple of 10 or 20 times that in terms of the game-changing impact that winning a major can make. So we want to make sure that that kind of impact on the game continues. But yes, we took a pretty significant increase last year because we do want to be, you know, major in a lot of ways. Exactly where we'll be in 2023 or 24 or 25 is still work to be done. But and I felt the same way on the women's side too. I mean, when I got here, we made a $5 million increase on the way to 12 million in the U.S. Women's Open, too. I want to make sure that when a player steps on a major platform with the heading USGA, everything about that can be life and career changing. I believe that is, and we'll continue to monitor that to make sure that never changes.
Mike, sticking with the pro game for a moment, at the Country Club, you said you were, quote, saddened by what's happening in the game. You used the word fracture. Are you more or less optimistic now than you seem to be in June?
Yeah, what I meant by that is it was difficult that, Damon, if you and I and Eamon were having a conversation right now and this hadn't happened, we would be talking about the greatest boom in golf history ever. I mean, we're talking about the kind of numbers that we always dreamed about, even as recently as 2019. And I feel like this parade is going by and we're not really paying attention to these incredible growth factors that are happening at our golf courses and in terms of diversity, in terms of youth game, because we're talking about, you know, just this one topic. I do think the game of golf is big enough for a lot of different venues and different tours. We've proven that before. So we'll find way, you know, to live long term. But what I meant by that is it's a shame that the average fan, if you ask them, what do you want to see when you turn on the golf on the weekend? They just want to see the best players in the world playing in the best venues of the world to find out who is the best in the world. And unfortunately, this has kind of fractured that a bit. But it doesn't mean the game won't be just fine. We've lived through our share of change, and this might be, you know, that kind of change as well. But the only thing that bothers me about all of this is how much attention it's taking away from this incredible both boom and opportunity we have to really double down on the growth of the game. And it's just a shame we don't get more chance. I've laughed before. I used to be in any interview, we would laugh about how fast will it take before somebody asked me a question about distance. And in the last year, I can't imagine more than a couple of questions about distance because everyone's talking about one topic, and that topic isn't the real growth of the game, but essentially a division among a really small percentage of the game.
Well, we are going to get to that distance question in due course, Mike, but you mentioned they're the best golfers in the world. Obviously, one way of determining those is the official World Golf Rankings. You're a member of the board. How did you feel whenever you've heard various LIV players and Greg Norman demand that the application be fast-tracked or that some of your fellow board members ought to recuse themselves from the process entirely?
Yeah, what I can tell you is I believe that anybody who applies for World Golf Rankings ought to be given the same approach, the same seriousness, the same review process, and that's what we're committed to. That we're committed to reviewing this, no different than we reviewed anything in the past, in the same process, because I think it's important for us to treat this no different than we've treated things in the past, and I'm committed to doing just that. As an individual board member, I can't speak for the others, but for me, it's important that we treat this like we've treated others, and that we understand at the outcome of this that the process we used was as fair and consistent as anything we've done in the past.
Mike, as you can probably tell, I was combing through your USGA, US Open transcript last night from June, and I recalled how stern you were when you were asked if a breakaway player could find it harder to get into a US Open in the future. You said bluntly, yes. Is that still the case?
Yes, that's still the case. I think it could be harder for a player that plays in a place that doesn't have the opportunity to showcase their skills among a similar kind of set and similar kind of week-to-week grind. Could it be harder to make it to an exempt status of the U.S. Open? Yes, but I mean, the difference between the U.S. Open and a lot of other championships, not just majors, but championships in general, is about half of our field is truly made up of open qualifiers. So if you want to play your way into a U.S. Open, that's been available to you for 100 years. It'll be available to you for the next 100.
In that press conference at the US Open, Mike, you did talk a lot with your colleagues about the distance debate and even the idea of, you know, reducing the forgiveness on off-center hits from drivers, things like that. Where are you in that process right now? And are you getting, in this feedback era, any kind of pushback from the manufacturers on it?
Yeah, we are actually in the feedback stage. We just closed sort of open comments about 3 weeks ago. So now we're in the process of compiling all those comments. I mean, fortunately, and I guess unfortunately, almost all of those comments come in the last 7 days, not in the 3 or 4 months that precedes it. So we'll take all that feedback. Are we getting pushback from manufacturers and others? Yes, I mean, of course. There's change is hard. I've been on the manufacturing side, I've been on the tour side, and I've been in the governing body side. And change isn't easy for any of us. And when people recommend or suggest significant change or change that we're analyzing, I would find it shocking if we didn't get some counterpoints. And we need to be open and listen. This process requires, I've said this many times, this process is probably good for Mike Wan, who's always in a hurry, because it forces me to stop, slow down, listen, learn, and then reapply. I think in the next couple of months, we'll take this learning and come back to the marketplace with any change that this would create relative to the approach we've shared back in March.
You're kind of in a unique position here, Mike, in that you've been at the top of two major organizations in the golf world. And there's a lot of conversation going on about the potential for any alignment between LIV Golf and the LPGA, as there has been with the Ladies European Tour. If you were still, you ran the LPGA for a decade, if you were still in that seat, how would you approach a conversation like that?
I'll be honest with you, Eamon. I get asked the if you were still there question, ... fill in the blank all the time. And I don't really feel like when I was the LPGA commissioner or running the LPGA, I had to deal sort of with the ghost of Mike Wan. So I don't want to create the ghost of Mike Wan. So I'm really proud of the team that's in place there. I trust Molly. She's a superstar and was part of the selection committee that elected her, and that board is some of my best friends in life. So I'm not exactly sure how I would attack it, because I'm not in the specifics in terms of what's being proposed or not being proposed. But even if I had a solution or had a suggestion, I probably wouldn't air it publicly, Eamon, just because at the end of the day, that's their business to run. I wouldn't ask them to publicly suggest what they would do to change the U.S. Women's Open, and I wouldn't probably suggest what I would do in that seat. But I trust the team that's there. I trust the athletes that are a part of it. I know they respect the game, and they respect the future of the game, and most importantly, they respect the fans. So wherever this goes and whatever they do or don't have in front of them, and I'll be honest with you, I don't know if they have a proposal in front of them. I know that they'll work through this in a way that's good for the game and good for the athletes that play it.
Mike, we threw a lot at you. You're like Aaron Judge as usual. Thanks for the time. Congrats on the idea grant, having spent some time with First Tee Kids. I know how impactful that will be. We'll speak to you down the line.
Thanks, guys. Thanks for what you do for the game.
The Korn Ferry Tour is doubling up on Cootie Brothers. The twins will both be out there next season. Pearson, already a winner on the Korn Ferry Tour. And after the break, we'll be joined by Parker. He secured his card last weekend. Stay with us. Well, it's that time of the year where dreams are achieved, deferred, or just plain crushed. We're talking Korn Ferry Q School, where players claw and scrape their way through multiple stages to inch closer to that ultimate dream of a PGA Tour card.
Eamon, last weekend, 3 of 5 stage 2 sites were held, and from one of the sites, former Texas Longhorn standout Parker Cootie earned his spot on the Korn Ferry Tour. Parker fired a final round 67, cruised through the second stage by 5 shots. We're joined now by Parker. Congratulations, Q School, man. It's such a gauntlet. What are you most proud of in advancing to the final stage?
Yeah, no, it's a different type of golf, but played steady, like you said, and really happy that it was an easy Q School, if I were to say that, but still one more stage to go.
Parker, you know, you come from a pretty decent line, a lineage of golfers here. You know, your grandfather, Charlie, won the Masters. Your dad played tour. Your brother's already out there. Was there any possibility you were going to do anything else for a living other than play golf?
Not that I know of within the past few years, at least. It's been, it's what I love to do, and I'm fortunate to be in a position to play professional golf.
Parker, I don't know if anyone's ever told you, but you've got the clutch gene. In similar situations, you once birdied 6 of 7, including your last 4 holes at PGA Tour Canada Q School. Do you enjoy the stress and embrace it even?
Yeah, no, I mean, it's a lot of fun. It's what you put yourself in position to do. If you can perform under pressure, I think it's one of the greatest feelings out there, and I love to be able to do it and hopefully continue to do it.
Parker, you won this year on the PGA Tour Canada, and your twin Pearson won out there in the Korn Ferry Tour. Do you guys draft off each other in terms of competition? Does the success of one fire up the other one?
Yeah, 100%. I mean, we've always kind of done that, whether it be other sports and now golf the past few years. So he's really set a high bar, like I said, but it's a great competition that we continue to have.
More clutch moments from you earlier this year, 2 aces in the same round. At least that's what I've heard at U.S. Open local at Forest Creek, 17th hole. Then you made the turn, and the 8th hole you made an ace as well. It was the 5-year anniversary of a previous ace that you made. What do you remember about the day at Forest Creek? Kind of describe those aces for us.
Yeah, no, it was a funny like thing. I got a Snapchat memory of my previous ace was 5 years ago on that day. I mean, not like a dry spell. I would never say there's a hole in dry spell, but I hadn't had one in a while. And yeah, I happened to have one on the 17th hole, and that was pretty cool. And then fast forward, like you said, to the 8th hole, and another one went in, and it was just kind of shock. It was very shocking. And the guys in my group had a great time with it and stuff. And it was definitely a lot of fun. And I mean, hopefully something I can do again. We'll see though.
It's got to be a pretty comforting situation to head into a professional golf career, knowing that you can call upon the advice from a guy who he knows where he's eating on Tuesday of Masters Week every year, Charlie Coody. What's the best advice you ever received from your grandfather as it relates to golf?
I mean, I would say he just, I mean, every time I talk to him, he just tells me to believe in myself and trust myself. He's obviously a great influence and a great golfer, but he's a better grandfather, and I couldn't thank him enough for that. But he believes in Pearson and I more than anyone out there. And that's saying a lot, especially from a guy who's competed at the highest level.
Parker, the game is in your DNA. It sounds like there's nothing else that you want to do, but man or woman can't live on golf alone. Yeah. When you're not playing golf, your next favorite hobby, Netflix, are you fishing? Like, what are you doing outside of golf?
I'm playing pickleball right now. It's so addicting. Me and my friends, there's about six of us at home that play four or five times a week. I mean, I would say that's my biggest hobby going right now. It's a lot of fun.
Pickleball is where 50-year-old ACLs go to die, Damon. I was told that, and I shouldn't actually do that. Parker, your brother said earlier this year that he had received an offer from LIV Golf that he declined because his goal was always to play the PGA Tour, and he couldn't imagine not achieving that goal. Were you ever approached with an offer as well?
Not necessarily. Mine was kind of on the contingency that Pearson took his. So I was never presented with a formal offer, but I can only echo what Pearson said as far as the goal is to play on the PGA Tour and be out there. And that's what we always dreamed of. And I would love nothing more than that.
Parker, I'm texting your old college coach, John Fields, several times a year, talking about the lineage of great players. What's your favorite memory at Texas in that program that continues to present wonderful professionals and win national championships as well?
I mean, it's going to be hard to ever beat the national championship this year at Greyhawk, walking off that way. I mean, that would be one of the fondest memories I've ever had, and definitely one of the greatest at UT with the guys and coaches and everything. It was truly a special moment, and I wish I could relive it, but it only happens once, obviously, and it's just a great feeling. I wish I could describe it better, but yeah, I'll never forget that.
Well, the bar for accomplishment is set pretty high in your family. Parker, what is your goal when you head out onto the Corn Ferry Tour next year? Is it granular in terms of here's areas of the game that I want to improve, or is it more kind of macro stuff about this is how many times I want to win, this is what I want to accomplish by year's end?
I think there's both. I mean, like in a couple of weeks, I got to go to final stage and I have to get guaranteed starts to be able to have a chance on the Corn Ferry. So, I mean, that's step one. But then, yeah, I mean, the goals are to get my tour card, play well out there. And there are things I want to improve, but I think those will ultimately help me get to the PGA Tour. So hopefully tick all those boxes going through the year. But no, step by step and go play well on the Corn Ferry.
Parker, congrats on getting through stage two. No spike in the football yet. Still got final stage. We'll speak to you soon, pal.
Thank you all. Appreciate it.
All right. Speaking of the University of Texas, Jordan Spieth at the mic at Congaree. We'll hear what the three-time major champ had to say ahead of his season debut.
The most entertaining thrill ride in golf. Ready to roll again. Jordan Spieth getting his season underway this week at the CJ Cup. We're going to hear from the Golden Child. And as the LPGA Tour heads into its final sprint, we'll take a look at the players sitting precariously close to the bubble. Some of the names might surprise you. And we'll introduce you to one of the newest cardholders on the Corn Ferry Tour. Golf Today, Hour 2, starts now.
Golf Today.
Golf
Golf Today continues on a Tuesday. Damon Hack alongside Eamon Lynch of Golf Week magazine, my friend right here, broke the news this morning that the PGA Tour is set to announce the four additional events with elevated status for 2023. Yes, this comes in addition to the nine that were already announced back in August. Four elevated events are expected to be the WM, Phoenix Open, RBC Heritage, the Wells Fargo Championship, and the Travelers Championship as well. And as you can see right there on your screen, they join the likes of the Players, the playoff events, and the Invitationals in elevated status. So what does that mean? Well, prior to the Tour Championship in August, Commissioner Jay Monahan announced a number of changes to the future structure of the PGA Tour to combat live golf and future defections. In that announcement, the commissioner introduced the idea of elevated events that would guarantee the presence of the game's biggest names, as well as a purse of at least $20 million. Now, earlier today, some players were asked about the news.
Yeah, I think it looks like it'll just be an extra one in a row. You know, if that's the case, you know, then that does put me and a few other people like Scotty Zalatoris, like some guys who like playing both the Dallas events, you know, in a situation where you're looking at five in a row. Which I've done once. I particularly like doing more than four in a row, but I love my hometown events. I've been playing them really well as well, and then just play the President's Cup well there at Wells Fargo. So with a major in there and then Jack's event, I think I just, you know, maybe I don't know what it's going to look like, but it looks like probably five in a row where I go into Jack's event on Tuesday night or something like that. At this point, that shouldn't be happening that soon. That would be, nowadays, I think you got to book like 2 years in advance, everything's so packed. So this next year will be a little easier on that front.
You know, sometimes when the schedule is set and you have to go play, it makes things easier, right? I mean, at least in my mind, it's like, okay, you have to play these events and then you organize the rest, which there's a simplicity to it in that sense. Plus, I mean, you're elevating great events. They're all amazing golf courses. They're all amazing events. A lot of history in all of them, so they're worthy of it. Hilton Head and Travelers after majors. I'm not keen on playing after a major, but I've seen people do it, and I've seen people do well, so there's no reason why you can't.
You had previously expressed some concern about the 20 event commitment. Can you say whether there's been any concessions made or if you feel better about it now than
you did a lot of it is going to have to be a combination of discussions with the European Tour for people like Rory and I, where we have those 20 events to play for the PGA Tour, and then you need to add three or four more with the European Tour, right? Plus the events you want to play. You don't want that number to get too high. And for us to get play more golf than we want to play before the Ryder Cup or after the Ryder Cup, you want to have, like Brian was asking, the proper time off as well. So, like I said, I think there's going to be some discussions to be made in that sense. But I also said last year, from Tournament of Champions till East Lake, I played 19 events. Right. I think this will count as one of my 20. It could be very similar to last year, but it won't change. So my schedule's been pretty similar every year. So, I mean, it's, again, here and there, you change some events that you may play and may not play. But the number adds up to the same.
Some player reaction to the story you broke this morning in Golf Week. Impossible to have everyone have the schedule that they want exactly. But I was struck by John Rahm's comment that at least we know what it will look like. You know, the Eagles know they're playing the Cowboys week six of the NFL. The Packers know they're playing, you know, the Giants in London. Does that certainty at least kind of help the players know more or less what they negotiated as a unit trying to combat these defections to live?
It does, and more than anything else, it probably helps the PGA Tour, because for the first time in the history of the PGA Tour, they can actually guarantee the product that they're giving to fans, to sponsors, to broadcast partners. They know who's going to show up and when they're going to show up and where they're going to show up. And that's a completely new thing in the world of golf. And, you know, that's one thing that LIV did, that the PGA Tour was wise to steal the idea of guaranteeing who is actually going to be there. And they are still independent contractors on the PGA Tour, so you're still going to see compromises being made in terms of where guys want to play, and frankly, in some cases, where they don't want to play. But everyone's got to kind of grin their way through this a little bit. And there will be a knock-on effect. Some tournaments will probably feel a little kind of left out of this process. Others will benefit if almost accidentally. I mean, you could argue that the Genesis Scottish Open might become a de facto elevated event, being the week before the Open Championship. Obviously, it's a DP World Tour event, but it's co-sanctioned by the PGA Tour. So you can see a lot of guys playing that one, because these guys are also required to play three non-elevated events. You've got these elevated events, you've got the major championships, and then there are three non-elevated events they must also commit to playing.
Right.
The Genesis Open seems a convenient one for a lot of those guys. But it was interesting hearing Rahm talk about the idea of how it fits with the DP World Tour schedule as well. We've already seen a report that the Irish Open may move from 2 weeks before the Open Championship to the week after the Tour Championship at Eastlake, which would then free up Rory McIlroy, Shane Lowry, guys like that, to go play in the Irish Open and still show some loyalty to the DP World Tour. I suspect in time you're going to see a lot of players take a break after the playoffs, and then you're going to see them move into DP World Tour events. We've seen John Rahm do it, obviously, and Shane Lowry at Wentworth, where they played well. Rory McIlroy played there. He played the Italian Open.
Right.
In that final race into the DP World Tour Finals in Dubai, I think you can expect to see a lot more of the top PGA Tour players show up there as well.
What about Jordan Spieth's sentiment? Wasn't angry, but just was saying, I don't really like to play five in a row, talking about the Texas swing that he and Scottie Scheffler typically play in. Is that going to be kind of a minimum of players, you think, a small number of players that are concerned about having to play four or five in a row? Or is that just kind of the nature of this beast in this competitive era?
It's the nature of the beast with this particular schedule, because remember, this is the schedule that the Tour had previously announced before this idea of elevated events really gathered steam. So
yes,
the Tour was forced to work with the schedule it has. What that schedule looks like in 2024 when they move to a calendar year schedule,
right,
I think you're more likely to see tournaments move around on the schedule like puzzle pieces, but you're always going to see these guys kind of have to compromise or do things that they don't necessarily want to do in terms of the schedule that they're accustomed to having. Playing 5 weeks in a row is pretty tough, certainly if you play all 5 weekends in a row, but it's not like you're taking an Amtrak from one tournament to another. It's the same thing with the going from the West Coast US Open next summer back to Travelers. You know, they're not driving there, and most of them ain't flying commercial either. So these are compromises that have to be made along the way. The schedule will probably look different. It will be set up more in 2024 to accommodate and pace the elevated events. The pacing had to be problematic for 2023 because every tournament and every date was locked in.
The players said they wanted to play against each other more often. This helps ensure that. And you have to think that the fans at home, knowing that the best players will be at these venues, will help as well.
Well, we've got a lot of good players at the venue this week as well. But the CJ Cup has been a subject to a game of musical chairs when it comes to venues, thanks to the COVID-19 pandemic. From South Korea to Nevada, now South Carolina. But that hasn't stopped the big names from winning the event. And last year, it was this guy, Rory McIlroy, who won at the Summit Club in Las Vegas by one shot over Colin Morikawa.
In a strong field as Rory returned to defend his title, you see Sam Burns, Hovland, Rahm, Spieth, Fitzpatrick, Kim, Morikawa, Scheffler, Dustin Thomas. This feels like a mid-season form in terms of the strength of this field in South Carolina this week. Now, you see the name Jordan Spieth on that notable list, three-time major champ, had an incredible week in Charlotte, North Carolina. It was the last time we saw him. Not much of a struggle when undefeated at Quail Hollow, earning the maximum 5 points for Team USA and their victory over the Internationals all week long. He was like vintage Jordan. He was making clutch putts from the parking lot and beyond. So earlier we played a little buy or sell with John Rahm. Now we move on to buy or sell with Jordan Spieth. Paige McKenzie, Jordan Spieth will end his major drought in 2023.
I'm selling this one very timidly. I mean, I love him every single year at the Masters. It's hard not to based on his record there. But I have already chosen Rory McIlroy in the Cinderella story there. And then when I look further down the list at the other major championship venues, Jordan Spieth has played at Hoylake and at Oak Hill, but not huge success. Of course, that was at the very beginning of his career. So I'm just not super confident with that selection, with Jordan Spieth as a selection for those venues. So I'm going to sell this one.
Damon, I know you probably have two majors assigned to Tom Kim already, but where does Jordan Spieth fit in your makeup here?
I tell you what, he missed the cut at the Masters. I've always kind of given him a puncher's chance, always at the Masters. He began his career at the Masters with the New York City area code, 212. I mean, second place, first place, second place. But since then, he hasn't quite been as, you know, money in the bank when he drives down the Magnolia Lane. So I don't think it's going to be a major championship for 2023 for Jordan Spieth. I respect the resume. I respect the grit in the fight. Remember that old Brad Gilbert book, Winning Ugly? Tennis, you know, a great book, by the way, if you're into tennis. And that's kind of how Jordan Spieth gets it done. Even at the height of his power, it wasn't always pretty. He fights. He finds a way, even when he's a little wayward off the tee. But I just see too many players right now that I think they're better than he is right now. As much as I respect his game and his fight and his grit, it would not surprise me should he win a major, but I can't tab one of those four big events right now with his current form to win a major in 2023.
There seem to be two places where Jordan Spieth finds this elixir of youth, and one of them is obviously Augusta. Excuse me. The other one is the Open Championship, T8 this year, second last year, because it's a test of imagination. And I don't know that there's a more imaginative player out there than Jordan Spieth, but I can't give him a major next year. I think he's a little too fickle on it. Some guys seem more consistent and built for those major championships. And frankly, they're just tough to win.
Yeah.
There are only four of them, and there are a lot more than four strong candidates.
Yeah,
every year.
I think I see Rory also. I see Morikawa having a bounce back. We just talked about John Rahm, Scotty Scheffler. Justin Thomas won a second major last year as well. It just seems like there are too many players right now that are playing great golf outside of Jordan Spieth that I would more easily, more readily tab for a major championship in 2023.
Well, what about Jordan Spieth then actually finishing? You know, we have this argument all the time, Paige, about this idea of his putting. Can his putter define 2023 for him? Is he going to have a good year if his putter is not performing?
To me, I see it's synonymous. He kind of needs the putter to have the consistency. Now, I know he won this past season talking about how poor his putting was that particular week. But I think when you look at it from a season length perspective, he's going to need the putter to show up. When you look at the four seasons that he's finished top 10 in the FedEx Cup, he's finished 60th, 9th, 2nd, and 48th in putting. So two of the years not stellar, but still positive, still better than the most as it relates to his putting. So and obviously 2 years where he's top 10 on the PGA Tour. So the way I look at it is when you look on the season as a whole, he's going to need that putter to show up. And the best seasons that he's had have proven that the putter has been a big part of it.
What do you think, Amy? Will his season be defined by that all-important flat stick?
I'm not so sure. I do support Paige's idea that over the course of a season, you're not going to have a great season if you're not putting well. To me, middle of the pack is kind of enough for a guy like Jordan Spieth. If you look when he won at Hilton Head earlier this year, he ranked 60th in putting in the field that week. The year before, when he won the Valero Texas Open, he was 6th that week. But in 2017, he won three times on the PGA Tour, including the Open Championship, and he was 48th for the year in strokes gained putting. So, yes, the putter has to show up, but it doesn't have to show up week in, week out, and he doesn't have to be the best. He's kind of like Rory McIlroy in a way that he has so many other tangibles and intangibles that work for him that if he just puts okay, it's often enough to put him right in the mix.
I agree, because when he's on with his irons, it's world class. And the question is, to me, the ball striking off the tee, you know, how comfortable is he? I think he's going to fight. I don't think the putter has to be super hot. I think that I'm a little bit concerned about the short putts with Jordan. At the same time, I think he's probably the most sublime putter from 30 feet, from 25 feet that I've seen since Tiger Woods or Ben Crenshaw. I think he's more likely to make a 35-footer sometimes than the 4-footers, which seem to, from time to time, get into his head. Even in the route of winning at Hilton Head, we saw him miss some short putts when he closed out that Saturday round before bouncing back on Sunday, ultimately beating Patrick Cantlay in that playoff. To me, the short putts can be a little bit troublesome, but I think the larger clubs that will define Jordan Spieth's season, it's more the iron play, and even more particularly the driver, which from time to time can get a little crooked.
And as we know, Paige, one thing we can say for certain, it's not going to be dull when Jordan Spieth's out there. Do you think that he has all of the weapons to have a successful season, even if the putter is perhaps not the Excalibur weapon it used to be?
Well, and I'm actually going to go back to the definition of the question, which will his season be defined by the putter? Because he's been such an extraordinary putter in his career, when he misses the short putts, we notice. So to some extent, he will be defined good or bad by the putter because it's a yardstick that we measure him by. The same way that we would measure Rory by his driving, we measure Jordan Spieth by his putting because he's set such a high watermark. So I'm going to go with semantics on the question and say, I think even though you both are saying that maybe his season will not be defined by the putter, I think at the same time, you kind of are making that argument.
Yeah, didn't miss a lot of putts.
She should have gone to North Carolina instead of Houston. You know that?
Can you imagine trying to litigate against Paige McKenzie in a courtroom?
I've tried. I've lost a couple
of times. My poor husband.
Tough enough in a TV studio, no doubt about it.